Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's informal courses for adults.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How did the Rehnquist Court change America? Chief Justice William Rehnquist presided over the U.S. Supreme Court from 1986 until his death in 2005. During that time, the court ruled on a number of landmark cases that my guest today says failed to protect Americans' civil rights and civil liberties, often to the benefit of government officials and institutions. Michael Avery is professor of law at Suffolk University in Boston. He is also the editor of a book of essays called We Dissent, Talking Back to the Rehnquist Court. Michael, welcome to Think.
Thank you.
How would you characterize the court's focus, if you could, during the Rehnquist years?
Well, the court was occupied with a number of matters, but there were a lot of cases, and these are some of the ones that we deal with in our book, involving the accountability of the government or government officers for violating the constitutional or civil rights of citizens. And it's the performance of the court in those cases in particular that is the focus of a number of the essays in We Dissent.
You could have put together criticisms of the court in a lot of different forms. Talk about why you asked these experts that contributed to the book to write dissents as if they had been submitted by members of the court.
Well, for a couple of reasons. One, because so many of the decisions that came down from the Rehnquist Court during this period of time either had no dissents or had dissents that didn't really seem to us to strike at some of the principled issues that should have been addressed by the court. And the second reason is that, after all, the law doesn't really belong to the Supreme Court. The Constitution doesn't belong to the Supreme Court. It belongs to the people of the United States. And so we wanted to make the point that any citizen has a right, at least on an intellectual level, to dissent from decisions from the Supreme Court.
Yeah, the single case in the book in which a dissent had been written was for Strickland versus Washington, which essentially gave a pass to incompetent attorneys appointed to serve criminal defendants. Can you talk about the nature of the dissent as written and then about the one that was actually contributed for the book?
Well, in Strickland versus Washington, there was an excellent dissent by Thurgood Marshall, who had been, as is well known, the lawyer for the NAACP Legal and Defense Fund. And Marshall had a long career as a civil rights lawyer, and he understood what it means, to ordinary people to have their rights violated. Strickland was a case where a man had been convicted of murder and sentenced to death. His lawyer had not done a very good job. In fact, his lawyer had really sort of given up because his client had confessed at one point, and the lawyer sort of lost heart and really didn't see anything that he could do to defend this man. And so he hadn't put on a case either with regard to whether or not the man was guilty or innocent or with regard to whether or not the man should be sentenced to death. He hadn't conducted any investigation, and he hadn't done much of a job for Mr. Strickland. Justice Marshall wrote an excellent dissent in the case, talking about the significance of a criminal defense lawyer to somebody facing these kinds of problems. We had a dissent written by Professor Abby Smith, who was a woman who had a long career as a criminal defense lawyer herself and who now teaches at Georgetown Law School in the Prettyman Clinic, which is a clinic in which students learn how to become criminal defense lawyers. And Professor Smith wrote a dissent which went even beyond the dissent that had been written by Thurgood Marshall, in which she articulated the idea that lawyers who represent criminal defendants really ought to be judged by the guidelines and the criteria that lawyers themselves use to judge members of our profession. And that if a lawyer can't meet the sort of professional requirements that we insist on in our profession, including, in this case, principally conducting an adequate investigation in a criminal case, that the courts ought to take those professional guidelines seriously and ought to use those guidelines to determine whether or not the lawyer's performance has been adequate. Unfortunately, the court said as long as the lawyer's performance is reasonably adequate, the defendant isn't entitled to a new trial. And that's such a low baseline and subject to you know, interpretation by judges and hasn't really proved to provide a guideline that has been very meaningful in terms of assuring people a competent lawyer.
And then there's the standard that things might be different if somehow the defendant could prove that the outcome would have been different had he or she had a different defense attorney.
Correct. And it's very hard to prove that the outcome would have been different. And Professor Smith suggests that you really shouldn't have to prove that the outcome would have been different, that if, in fact, you can show that your lawyer's performance was well below the professional standard, that you should be entitled to a new trial.
So, in other words, even someone who is guilty deserves a decent defense attorney.
Certainly. Mm-hmm. I mean, the rules don't just exist to protect the innocent. One of the hallmarks of our justice system is that we don't start out by assuming innocence or guilt and then just provide the rules to protect the innocent. We start out by presuming that everybody's innocent, and then we try to give everybody as fair a trial as possible.
Michael Avery is my guest. He's professor of law at Suffolk University and the editor of a collection of essays called We Dissent, Talking Back to the Rehnquist Court. One of your concerns about the nature of the court today and the way it operates is that most of the justices don't pass what you call the Kleenex test. Would you explain that?
Yes. I'm glad you asked me about that. Most of the justices on the Supreme Court are people who in their professional careers represented business interests, or they worked for the government, or they were professors, they were in academia, but they didn't represent ordinary people with legal problems. They didn't represent people in trouble. They weren't the kind of lawyers who, as I put it, had to keep a box of Kleenex on their desk because the people who came to see them were frightened and cried about their legal problems. Of all the justices on the Supreme Court today, probably only Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg had to keep a box of Kleenex on her desk for the people who came to see her. Certainly a great justice like Thurgood Marshall would have passed the Kleenex test, but most of the justices that we have, not just on the Supreme Court, but on the courts of appeals around the country, or even a lot of our judges on the trial courts, the district courts around the country, are not people who represented individuals with legal problems. And I think, and I'm hoping now that we have President Obama, that we'll get more judges who really understand what civil rights and constitutional rights mean from the perspective of individual Americans who've had their rights violated.
Yeah, so it's not to say that these other justices come in necessarily with a bias against the sorts of people that would use the Kleenex on the judge's desk or on an attorney's desk. It's a matter of them not even being familiar really with the realities of their situation.
Certainly, and the fact that somebody can pass the Kleenex test doesn't mean that he or she would be a good judge. I mean, we still need judges who have, the correct legal education and who have a sophistication and who have all the other experiences and knowledge that are required. But people who've spent their entire life in corporate America or in academia or working for the government are missing something. They're missing what I call a feeling for the Constitution, a feeling for civil rights and human rights. And you can see that if you read the opinions of the Rehnquist Court or the Roberts Court today. And that's a negative thing.
It's an interesting segue to the case of Cuyahoga versus Buckeye, in which the court essentially rules that a victim of racial profiling has to prove that the official who committed that had the intention to discriminate. And the dissent here insists that discrimination is often unintentional these days, but it's equally harmful as it would be if it were intentional.
This is one of the best essays in the book. Susan Serrano and Eva Patterson, who are with the Equal Justice Society in San Francisco, have taken on one of the biggest problems with regard to the jurisprudence under the Equal Protection Clause. That is, the law that we now have requires somebody who's a member of a racial minority to prove not only that the government has discriminated factually against that person. In other words, not only that whites are getting a better deal than the person in the minority group, but that the government intended to discriminate against them, that there was purposeful discrimination taking place. Number one, that can be very hard to prove, sometimes impossible to prove. And number two, as Patterson and Serrano point out in their dissent, that doesn't really reflect the nature of discrimination in society today. A lot of discrimination is unconscious. A lot of it is a result of stereotyping that takes place at an unconscious level. So they use some very sophisticated concepts about cognition theory and different aspects of social theory to explain how discrimination really takes place in society today, that it's not a question of purposeful discrimination. And I must say that the Supreme Court of the United States has never really developed an adequate understanding of how racial discrimination takes place in our society. And so that's one of the biggest problems with our jurisprudence with regard to race relations.
Michael Avery is my guest. He's professor of law at Suffolk University in Boston. We'll return to our conversation with Michael in just a moment, and you can get on the line to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. We're talking about his new book, We Dissent, Talking Back to the Rehnquist Court. We would also invite you now, Jeff Whittington is here, the senior producer of Think, to call our other telephone number, 1-800-456-5372. I believe, Jeff, that we have copies of Michael's book.
You believe correctly.
Excellent. At the $120 level?
That is correct.
Great.
The typical hardback book membership gift level, and we're thrilled to make this book, We Dissent, available to you if you're interested in a copy. Of course, it is out, and I say it every time because I just want to be clear, we're not selling these books for $120. They're available at the bookstore. They're available online. We would encourage you because we think it's a worthwhile topic of conversation. We're always thrilled when our audience decides to go a step further and look more into the topic. But if you are predisposed to read the book and you want to support KERA at the same time, we're thrilled to offer you a copy of the book when you join the station at the $120 membership level.
1-800-456-5372 is the telephone number. You can also go online to kera.org. Did an interesting thing with this book, Jeff, because it is absolutely written in such a way that you do not have to be a legal scholar in order to understand it, but there is extensive documentation after every chapter so that you can follow up on other arguments and you can go and search things out. So if you are, in fact, a legal scholar or an attorney or someone in the legal profession, the book will not be below your level. It's very seldom that we find something that sort of strikes both notes, and so it's definitely, I would call it a recommended read.
And of course, with the new administration and the potential down the road in the next few years, maybe for some new Supreme Court justices, obviously looking at how the Supreme Court has worked in the past couple of decades, it lends itself to a little analysis and maybe how it might end up working down the road. Chris, I was actually, while you were talking, I was talking with our pledge producer, and apparently our friends at the Dallas Museum of Art have offered some additional pairs of tickets to see the King Tut exhibit.
Excellent.
Now, these are VIP tickets. They are not sold to the public. They're exclusive to KERA. Apparently, we last time we talked about these, we ran out of them. Some people called. We were out of them. But our friends at the DMA said, hey, we've got some more. So we just got these. And the VIP status allows you to come anytime during museum hours. You can see the exhibit through the VIP line. We have 19 sets of tickets, and they're available at the $120 membership level on a credit or debit card only.
Great. So you can make a $120 contribution. You can get those, not wait in the long line, or you might choose the book by Michael Avery.
Exactly.
Either way, we would love to hear from you right now. 1-800-456-5372 is our telephone number. You can also go online to kera.org. Again, those VIP tickets, if you want those as your thank you gift, you have to use a credit or debit card.
Yeah, you have to call, too, because obviously they're keeping track of how many
pairs of tickets there are. Okay, great. Well, give us a call right now, 1-800-456-5372, or go to kera.org. Back in just a minute to our discussion with Michael Avery.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses beginning in January. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You You are listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Michael Avery is my guest. He teaches law at Suffolk University in Boston. He is the editor of a collection of essays called We Dissent, Talking Back to the Rehnquist Court. If you'd like to support KERA at the $120 level and you would like to have a copy of Michael Avery's book, We Dissent, you can call us now at 1-800-456-5372 and the volunteers will hook you up. If you want to join the conversation, get on the line at 1-800-933-5372 or email think at KERA.org. Michael, one of Justice Rehnquist's most famous assertions was of the limitations of the 14th Amendment, which offers essentially a broad definition of U.S. citizenship. Can you talk about how others have tried to apply that and how Rehnquist and his court have responded over the years?
You're speaking about U.S. citizenship in what sense, Chris?
Well, it essentially offers particular protections. Why don't you go ahead and define the 14th Amendment so that in the way that it applies in the book and to some of the other rulings that you've talked about?
Okay. Well, I mean, one of the interesting cases in the book, I'm not sure it's exactly what you're bringing up, but let me talk about what I think is one of the most interesting cases in the book, which is the essay by Professor Raskin about election law. And this is also a case that comes up under the 14th Amendment and the First Amendment, and it involves a plaintiff who was conservative. So it's kind of interesting that a book like ours that was written by a bunch of basically liberal law professors and constitutional lawyers would sort of take up the cause of a conservative plaintiff. But Ralph Forbes was a conservative candidate for Congress in Arkansas, and he was a third-party candidate. He wasn't the Republican nominee, and he wasn't the Democratic nominee, and he wanted to participate in a televised debate on the educational television channel in Arkansas. And so he was rejected. Arkansas Educational Television rejected him because they didn't think he was electable. And he litigated his case up to the United States Supreme Court, and the United States Supreme Court upheld what the Arkansas Educational Television Channel had done and said that it wasn't necessary for them to put this conservative Ralph Forbes on the televised debate, that it was only necessary for them to put the Republican and the Democratic candidates on, and that they could limit the debate to the Republican and the Democratic candidates. Now, that's an interesting case, and there were some dissents written by some of the justices on the Supreme Court, but Professor Jamie Raskin from American University wrote a dissent for our book in which he really explains that the Supreme Court has kind of constitutionalized the two-party system. And, of course, the Constitution doesn't say anything about the two-party system. As a matter of fact, back at the time when the Constitution was drafted, some of the framers of the Constitution thought we'd be better off without any political parties, although pretty quickly after the country was founded, we developed political parties. But there's nothing in the Constitution about the two parties, and unfortunately, the Supreme Court has issued a number of rulings in which they've sort of protected the two-party system from challenges by third parties. And Professor Raskin has written an extremely interesting dissent here in which he says it's really up to the voters to decide who's electable, not up for the managers of public television stations or for judges on the Supreme Court to decide who's electable, and that it really was a violation of candidate Forbes' right to run for office. One of the interesting things about that story is, of course, in a lot of districts in the country, either the Republican or the Democrat is also some completely unelectable because the districts are gerrymandered in a way so that, you know, we know in advance that either the Republican or the Democrat wins time after time. So it was, in a way, a little ridiculous to say Mr. Forbes couldn't be in the debate because he didn't have a chance of winning. If that was the standard, we wouldn't have debates in a lot of our districts.
Well, it brings up an interesting question, and I think most people would not argue the fact that the Supreme Court has never been an entirely apolitical body. But do you think that it is more political or was more political during the years of the Rehnquist Court than it had been previously?
I think that the Supreme Court has always been political. even going back to Marbury versus Madison, which is the case that we all start our constitutional law courses with, when John Marshall, the great Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, first established the court's power of judicial review over decision-making by the legislature and actions taken by the executive branch. But I think what we saw during the Rehnquist court that was unusual was a very activist court, which was interesting because a lot of times conservatives say they don't like activist judges, that they think there's something wrong with activist judges. But in fact, the Rehnquist court was very activist in terms of striking down legislation. So that was an interesting way in which it was political. And then it was also political in terms of protecting the government and government officials from lawsuits. I say in the introduction to the book that you could get the idea that Chief Justice Rehnquist thought it was the purpose of the Constitution to protect the government from the people instead of to protect the people from the government, which really is why we have the Bill of Rights, to protect the people from overreaching by the government. So I think it was political in a couple of particular ways.
Yeah, one of those cases in which the government was protected against lawsuits was Alden versus Maine. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Alden versus Maine was an interesting case in which some probation officers in Maine had not received their overtime pay. And there's a federal statute, the Fair Labor Standards Act, which entitles all employees, whether they work for the government or whether they work for private industry, to get overtime pay. And if your employer doesn't pay you your overtime pay, then you can file a lawsuit. So they went to federal court initially and filed a lawsuit, and they were thrown out of federal court because the 11th Amendment to the Constitution says you can't sue a state in federal court. And they had tried to sue the state of Maine in federal court, so they were thrown out. So then they went to Maine state courts, and they tried to bring their claim, which was a claim under federal law, in the Maine state courts. Well, you can bring claims under federal law in the state courts. The Supremacy Clause in the Constitution says all the courts in the country, state and local courts, have to enforce the federal laws. So there was nothing wrong with that. But the Supreme Court ended up deciding that the state of Maine was protected by something called sovereign immunity. Now, sovereign immunity is a doctrine that goes back to the English kings and basically was a doctrine that said you can't sue the king unless he gives you permission to sue him. You can't sue the king unless the king allows you to sue him. That made some sense when we were talking about kings, because kings had absolute power. It's not a doctrine which makes a lot of sense in a democracy, and Professor Chemerinsky, Irwin Chemerinsky, who's now the dean of Irvine Law School in California, wrote a dissent for our book in which he said, there's really not very much reason to think that the people who wrote the United States Constitution and who started this brave new experiment in democracy in America intended to take over this doctrine of sovereign immunity that protected the English king. And so because the Constitution itself doesn't say anything about protecting the sovereign in state courts, but only says you can't sue the state in federal courts, Professor Chemerinsky believes, and I certainly agree with him, that there's no basis for saying that these probation officers couldn't have sued to get their overtime pay in the state courts in Maine. And in fact, he says, it's inconsistent with the idea of democratic values to say that you can't sue the government. So that's the first essay in the book. Professor Chemerinsky is, I think, one of the most well-known authors that we have in the book. Professor Chemerinsky is somebody that I would certainly recommend to President Obama as a good candidate to put on the Supreme Court when he has a chance to make some appointments to the court. And it's one of the most interesting essays in the book, I think.
How likely is it that President Obama will get to make an appointment during his tenure to replace one of the more conservative justices?
Well, I think it's highly likely that he'll have a chance to make at least two appointments, and some people say as many as four appointments during his first term. Justice Stevens, who's usually described as kind of a maverick justice, he votes with the moderates on the court most of the time, is very old and may retire. Justice Souter, who of course was appointed by George Bush Sr., to the court and was expected to be a conservative justice, has turned out to be a moderate justice. Some people say Justice Souter doesn't really enjoy himself very much on the court, so he may retire. Justice Scalia has spoken about being tired and talked publicly about how long he's been on the court and about how frustrated he is that he doesn't seem to be able to persuade other people on the court to adopt some of his more extreme conservative views. I don't know how long he'll stay on the court. It's speculative to try to figure out exactly who's staying and who's going, but certainly if President Obama serves two terms, the chances that he could appoint as many as four justices to the Supreme Court are quite high. And, of course, law is made not just by the Supreme Court, but by the district judges and by the Court of Appeals judges, and the chances that President Obama will appoint, you know, a great many of those judges are guaranteed.
Michael Avery is my guest. He's professor of law at Suffolk University and editor of a new collection of essays published in a book called We Dissent, Talking Back to the Rehnquist Court. We'll be back to our discussion with Michael Avery in just a moment. If you'd like to join us, you can get on the line at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. If you would like to join us as a member, Jeff Whittington is here now. If you'd like to join us as a member, you can call us at 1-800-456-5372. You know, Jeff, I'm going to a seminar this weekend, and I was asked to bring one small object that means a lot to me, that symbolizes something important in my life. And I was thinking about this and thinking about it, and I thought, well, the things that mean the most to me in my life are, you know, my children and my husband and my family.
So you're taking your daughter?
She's small, but not that small. I think it's like something that fits in my purse. But I mean, I couldn't think of that. And then I thought the other thing that's really important to me is ideas and this sort of the life of the mind. And it's hard to find an object to do that. And then it got me thinking really about a public radio membership, that you're not buying an object. You're not paying for something that you will keep in your pocket. You're paying for something that you keep in your head.
So you're going to take your member card?
Really?
You know, everyone's going to look at you
girl,
and go, what a dork.
I know. They're going to think, what a kiss up. No, I haven't decided what I'm going to bring
in.
Okay. But I'll think of something.
Chris, this is why we do it, to be able to have these kinds of discussions. This is why you listen, you, the listener, is to be able to listen to a conversation about the Rehnquist Court, about how sort of history reflects, even with a new administration, on the future. I think it's a great conversation, and it's what public radio is all about, sort of the unfettered exchange of ideas and conversation about topics that, you know, don't really get covered that much in the mainstream media. I mean, around Dallas, Fort Worth last night, every news broadcast was all about, you know, Ice Force One or Winter Storm 2009 or whatever they're going to call it, Icy Blast 09.
Until the Super Bowl segment came on, and then
exactly.
That's what it was about.
Exactly. And, you know, we're covering that too. And as a matter of fact, I just want to tell everybody, if you're already sort of thinking about getting out of work early, how you're going to make your way home, I've spoken to Justin Martin, our All Things Considered host here locally, and apparently he, Shelley Coughlin, the news director, and Bill Zeeble are working out sort of how they're going to cover it. So you can rest assured that KERA, and stay tuned to KERA, will keep you informed on all the weather situations, all the traffic situations around North Texas. And, you know, that's something that gets paid for with your contributions as well.
1-800-456-5372 is the telephone number. You can also take care of this online at kera.org. The great thing about being a KERA member is that you're not sending money into some vast black hole where you're not quite sure what's going to happen to it. You can check in on how your investment is being spent every single day, and you will gain back. I have to tell you, I think, you know, $10 or $20 a month invested in KERA pays back five times that value in terms of what you get that you can use at work and in your personal life and in making decisions about the way the world should go and political decisions. I think there is, it's almost hard to put a value value on it, but we ask you to try and do that, and then give us a call.
Think about when you were a student and you couldn't afford to support your public radio station, whether you were here in North Texas or elsewhere in the country, and you thought, you know, this station makes such a huge difference to me as a student, broadening my views, giving me the tools to make me a well-informed citizen of my community, of the region, of the country, of the world. And, you know, think about the impact that your contribution right now to KERA, a $200 contribution, a $300 contribution, the impact that that makes on the students of today, the people who are just beginning their adult lives, their careers, their educations, who can also not afford to support the station necessarily at a level that maybe you can now. And someone was there paying for this public radio station or paying for that public radio service that you used when you were in that student, poor student's shoes. And now you have the opportunity to do the same so that this service exists for everyone in the North Texas community. Please call 800-456-5372. Please put a value on that kind of availability of a service that everybody can get.
It's, I think in some ways, Jeff, it's sort of good radio karma. If you are in a position now, if you're working and your life is going well, you're in a position to support the station, you should do it because it's a way of being grateful that your life is progressing well. And even in a tough economy, things are such that you can find a little bit extra in your budget and do it. Become a member now because it will pay dividends to you and also to everybody else around you who is able to listen. 1-800-456-5372 is the number.
We did find out before the last break that the Dallas Museum of Art called us up. They have offered an additional 19 pairs of VIP tickets to see the King Tut exhibit over at the DMA. This is available at the $120 level when you use a credit or debit card. You've got to call 800-456-5372. These are not sold to the public. They're exclusive to KERA in this offer, and the VIP status allows you to come anytime during museum hours and see the exhibit through the VIP line. This is a great deal. You support KERA. You get to see the King Tut exhibit at the DMA in this sort of VIP status. And we only have 19 pairs of these available at the $120 level.
Yeah, it's especially nice if you're bringing people in from out of town and you really want to treat them and don't want to stand there in line for however long it takes. So think about supporting KERA and getting these great VIP tickets to King Tut. You can also, at the $120 level, get a copy of Michael Avery's book. Give us a call now, 1-800-456-5372, or go online to kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses beginning in January. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Michael Avery, who is professor of law at Suffolk University. His new book is called We Dissent, Talking Back to the Rehnquist Court. You can get a copy of this book with our compliments when you join the station at the $120 level or above. The number is 1-800-456-5372. You can also take care of that online at kera.org. If you want to speak to Michael Avery and join the conversation, our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think at kera.org. You yourself contributed the essay that dissented to Sacramento versus Lewis, which had to do with high-speed police chases and reckless behavior. Can you talk about why you think the court erred on this decision?
Sure. Actually, we have four chapters in the book that deal with police misconduct, and police misconduct is what I spent most of my time as a lawyer occupied with. In Sacramento versus Lewis, there was a high-speed police chase of two teenagers on a motorcycle. The kids hadn't committed any crimes that the police were aware of. The driver of the motorcycle had simply refused to stop for the officer when he had first tried to wave him down. And then they had chased after these kids at speeds up to 100 miles an hour. At one point, the police car crashed into the motorcycle at high speeds, and the passenger on the motorcycle, who hadn't really done anything wrong except to be riding on the motorcycle, was killed. And he ended up filing a lawsuit against the police officers. And when the case got to the United States Supreme Court, the court decided as a matter of civil rights law that even if the police had shown a reckless indifference to life, in connection with their conduct of the high-speed police chase, that a reckless indifference to life was not enough of a basis for a civil rights suit. And I thought that was fundamentally wrong. I thought that if police officers who are sworn to protect and serve the public and whose basic obligation is to protect life, that if they exhibit a reckless indifference to life, that that should be a sufficient basis for a civil rights suit. The court required them to show that they were, that they really had an intent to do harm, that they really intended to cause harm to this young man. And of course, that would almost always be impossible to prove. So I felt very strongly about that case. I had, when I was in practice, I had represented a young girl who got permanent brain injuries as a result of being struck by a car that was being chased by the police, and she was left without a remedy in a civil rights case because of that type of ruling. And I think the court was just off base there and not giving citizens the kind of protection they deserve.
Yeah, and when you say off base, this sort of reckless behavior would get most police officers in most departments across the country suspended, if not fired, from their jobs based on the policies just within the local department.
Well, that was something interesting that I pointed out in my dissent, which is that most of the departments across the country, as you just said, have internal rules that require the officer to take into account whether a high-speed chase is going to do more harm than good, whether the risks that the officer is creating are greater than the risks that he's trying to solve by conducting the chase. And so, ironically, police chiefs and training officers expect more from their officers than the Supreme Court seems to do, and that doesn't seem right. I think that judges ought to expect at least as much from police officers as police chiefs expect from them. Or to put it another way, I think police chiefs have a more realistic understanding of what we can expect from police officers than the justices on the Supreme Court do. And I suppose that, in a way, comes back to what we were talking about before, which is that, unfortunately, we've selected a lot of justices for the Supreme Court without regard to whether they really understand what's happening on the street, whether they really understand what's happening in real life the way average people live it.
Is that going to be harder and harder as we continue to select justices from this sort of rarefied world who will make more money and perhaps a bigger name for themselves if they stay in corporate practice and in places that sort of keep them off the street?
Well, you know, I don't think that's how we should select justices. And this is what I'm hoping President Obama will do. I'm hoping President Obama will go out and find, both for judges at the district court level and on the courts of appeals and the Supreme Court, lawyers who have represented people who are looking at the death penalty, criminal defendants who are facing the death penalty, lawyers who are 40, 45, 50 years old who have 20, 25 years of experience representing people who are charged with crime, lawyers who've worked for legal services offices across the country representing poor people who have lost their jobs, who can't pay their mortgages, who, you know, have had trouble dealing with their landlords and utility companies. I would hope that they would go to organizations like the Mexican-American Legal Defense Fund or other organizations who've represented farm workers and get lawyers who've had the experience of representing working people. You know, there were a lot of lawyers who went to Ivy League law schools or other very good law schools who have excellent academic credentials, who understand the intricacies of American constitutional law and other significant doctrinal areas, but who've decided to devote their lives to the representation of ordinary people. So, you know, you don't have to get corporate lawyers to get smart lawyers, and we could choose some of these other lawyers to be on the court, and I think we'd be a lot better off.
How well, Michael, do you think Americans outside the legal profession tend to understand the ramifications of major rulings as they're handed down?
You know, unfortunately, and I'm not speaking about you, Chris, because obviously you are quite a student of the law, I've observed.
Well, I had a good book to read.
Hour of conversation. But unfortunately, the media tends to focus on a few big issues. Let's say abortion, the exclusionary rule, how evidence is thrown out of trials because the police violate people's constitutional rights, maybe the Guantanamo cases. You know, a few big cases, but the media very seldom talks about the kind of cases that we talk about in this book. A lot of very important decisions that the Supreme Court makes really do not get discussed either in, you know, on the front page of the major newspapers or on radio or television. And so the public has very little understanding of the law as it's developing. And I'm afraid our educational institutions, you know, the colleges and the high schools, don't do a very good job of educating young people as they're coming up about laws that's being made. So I think most Americans really, it's not their fault, but they have a very poor understanding of what the court is actually doing.
There are obviously defensible reasons for the lifetime appointment of Supreme Court justices, but I'm wondering if you think that that allows us to adequately hold the Supreme Court accountable for the decisions it makes.
That's something that's being debated by a lot of people today. A lot of people think if we had, you know, 15 or 20-year terms, we still would have judicial independence, but we would have greater accountability. I personally don't have a strong view on that, but I think it's something that it's interesting to talk about in order to bring up the question of judicial accountability. I think it's a tough question. I the one thing I'm absolutely opposed to is popular election of judges, because we have that in most states, and it results in some terrible decisions being made and a lot of money being spent on elections, and you get kind of a lowest common denominator sometimes with respect to judges. I think judicial independence is very, very important. But we do have to insist that politicians at the federal level select judges who are going to represent a broad, diverse section of American thought. And for the last 20 years, that hasn't been the case.
Michael Avery is professor of law at Suffolk University in Boston. He is the editor of a book of essays called We Dissent, Talking Back to the Rehnquist Court. Michael, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Chris.
Thanks to all of you who have listened and also made financial contributions to the station today and throughout this week of the winter membership campaign for 2009. If you are yet to do so, you can call us right now at 1-800-456-5372, or you can go online to kera.org. We have just 6 pairs left, I am told, of those special VIP passes to the King Tut exhibition at the DMA. When they're gone, they're gone. We can't get any more, and this is something pretty special. Those are available with a $120 contribution at 1-800-456-5372. You do have to have your credit or debit card on hand in order to take advantage of that.
Yeah, or memorized.
I have mine memorized, actually.
Do you really?
Yeah, for online purchases.
Gosh, folks, we learn so much about the Chris Boyd
when you don't need to know.
When we have these unplanned, completely off-the-cuff conversations. Well, you know, we said that yesterday or the day before, too, that this is all we had, and they called us and said we've got some more.
So we're not lying to you and pulling more out.
Yeah, you never know. You never know. But there are 6 pairs left. We do want to thank Bronson and Kathy Davis. In Fort Worth, they renewed their Friends membership.
Oh, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Also, Jerry Wallace in Hearst and Anjanette Boole in Plano, they have done their part. How about you? Why not join the thousands of people who are going to support KERA during this drive? You know, you've always thought about supporting KERA. You've listened for years, perhaps. Maybe you've just discovered KERA in the last few weeks or months. This is how we raise the money. Maybe you turn to public radio during coverage of the campaign and presidential election. We know that thousands and thousands of you, hundreds of thousands of you did. Did you get something out of that coverage? Have you enjoyed the coverage of the new administration? It's a historic time in American history right now. It's exciting. It's important that you know what's going on. That's what you get from KERA. So why not support it at 800-456-5372?
You can also go online to kera.org. There has been, and Jeff, I know that you've read this too, some interesting new research about the way people give and the time in their lives that people choose to give. It used to be that people would wait until they were in their 50s to become significant contributors to charitable causes or to nonprofits or to community organizations like KERA. Now, Gen X, which is roughly people who are in their maybe early 30s to mid 40s, are really sort of taking on the mantle at a much earlier age than their parents did. And what they're looking for in many cases is a cause that they can feel like they are investing money in, as opposed to simply sort of throwing money at and watching from a distance. KERA is something you don't watch from a distance. You engage with every single day. So if this is something that you've considered adding to your life, the idea of really supporting something that you believe in, consider KERA. You're already using it. You're listening, as we always say, during the membership drive, so you must be a fan. Think about it. Give us a call at 1-800-456-5372. Try membership out for a year and see if you don't just really feel great about it.
1-800-456-KERA is the number to call. Online at kera.org. It's a service that you depend on to be here every time you turn the radio on. You know, Sam Baker walks in the morning and turns on Morning Edition, and it goes out over the air absolutely free. And we know that you know you can just listen for free. You know, we're aware of that. We know how many of you are listening, roughly. Hundreds of thousands of you. We know how many of you for sure are supporting. About 30,000 people actually support KERA and are active members.
And we know you're not flossing as much as you say.
Well, probably not. But we would love to have you join the ranks of the thousands of people who do support KERA, who do think that their listening is important enough, that the service is important enough for the community, that they invest not a whole lot of money, maybe a couple hundred dollars a year. Maybe you're a current member, you joined in the fall or you renewed in the fall. How about another $50 during this membership campaign? Lots of people are giving additional gifts to help move this drive along, to sort of set an example for others, to help finish the drive earlier than if they hadn't given. So why not you? Online at KERA.org, on the phone at 800-456-KERA.
It is very simple to become a member of the station. It's not some big involved process. We do take a little bit of information about your bank if you set up a sustaining membership, but that is, I have to say, once you get that set up, you are just done. It's great. People really love this. And maybe right now you're a sustaining member at $30 a month. Maybe you want to switch that to $40 or $50 a month, or you could make an adjustment that way. You can make an additional gift, or perhaps you're currently a member, but you want to now convert your membership to sustaining. Give us a call at 1-800-456-5372. We have thus far raised $138,500. We would love to see this at $140,000 by the end of Think Today, which is about a minute and a half, 2 minutes.
Well, it's almost 28% of the goal for the drive, Chris. And that's really remarkable considering that we're halfway through the second full official day of fundraising. We started on Friday, heard from many, many of you over the weekend and on Friday. And yesterday was a great day on the membership campaign. So is today. And you know what? It's a great day because you are taking that next step. You're picking up the phone. You're dialing 800-456-5372. You're going to KERA.org. And if you are concerned about the weather today, and I just want to say once again, if you are sort of thinking about getting out of work early, making plans to that effect, stay tuned to KERA because the news team is getting some information and will be updating you through the afternoon on weather and road conditions.
You know, supporting KERA is a pretty simple choice to make, I think. If we all believe that the world is better off with public radio in it, that North Texas specifically is better off with a great public radio station, one of the most lauded in the country, you should know, then it's worth the money to keep it going. You know, if we all believe it should be here, then we all have a responsibility to take action and keep it here. We at the station, we're not required to do this, but we practice what we preach. We are pretty much everyone on the staff here is a member. Yes, we draw our salaries from here, but we also belong to the station as members because this is something that we believe in. We believe it's worth spending money. So please give us a call now. Join us at 1-800-456-5372, and you will be supporting your source for NPR News, KERA 90.1, Dallas, Fort Worth, Denton, and online at kera.org.
Four pairs of VIP King Tut tickets at the Dallas Museum of Art. Thanks to the Dallas Museum of Art for making those tickets available to our members who join at the $120 level on a credit or debit card only. You must call 800-456-5372 to avail yourself of those tickets. And again, just four pairs left. of those tickets, and they're going really, really quickly.
It's starting to feel like eBay now, where people are thinking, well, I don't know. Now that there are four left, I guarantee there are probably, you know, many people who are just about to get on the phone. So if you want this, we would urge you not to wait. 1-800-456-5372. If you believe in KERA, if you get value out of the programming on KERA, we would also encourage you not to wait, because we will be done with the drive faster, and we will all appreciate that. Again, the website is kera.org. The telephone number, say it with me, 1-800-456-5372. Thanks so much.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.